You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Hello, I'm back. This is Alan Jennings, your host on Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. You know, the election's over. The freak-out mode of the prospect of another 4 years of circus is over, although I'm not particularly sure of that because the president has talked about running for re-election in 2024, which would give him another 4 years of being on the stage, taking pot shots at the president any chance he gets. He's proven himself to be just completely out of control with kind of temper tantrum about being not reelected and rejected by the American people after 4 years of absolute craziness. One of the things that you do post-election, though, is you think about what constituencies played what role. And there were many constituencies, obviously. This is a very diverse country. And one of the things that became very clear was that people of color sometimes turn out, sometimes don't. Republicans are always diehard in their turnout. You usually have to worry about turnout. It's the Democrats who do. And a key constituency for us, if you will, and I have to admit that for full transparency, that I am a liberal. I'm registered as a Democrat. And so from the side that I'm on, getting the people who most can benefit from their democracy to vote is a challenge. And I know that just a few weeks before the election, Democrats ran a poll and discovered that 25% of Bernie Sanders supporters were not going to vote for Joe Biden. They weren't going to vote for Donald Trump, but they weren't going to vote for Joe Biden. And that was something that freaked everybody out. Young people who were very supportive of Bernie Sanders also were a fear. And so when it comes to talking about young people, it's best to talk to young people. And so on my show tonight, the guests are Joel Paulson, who is a graduate of Saucon Valley High School. But impressively, he is now, Joel, you're a junior.
That's correct.
He's a junior at Swarthmore College. So for those of you who don't pay attention to college ranks, Swarthmore is arguably as good a school as any Ivy League school. People think of Harvard and Yale as the great colleges in this country, but there is a whole bunch of elite private liberal arts colleges, four-year schools, Middlebury, Williams, Haverford, Swarthmore, that are the cream of the crop. And Joel Paulson, African-American young man from Saucon Valley, is at Swarthmore College. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
My second guest is Berto Sicard. Berto is a graduate of Allen High School. He is Puerto Rican, and he is a graduate of Lehigh University, and in the fall next year will be going to Yale University's School of Law. These two are as impressive as any young men I've ever met, and I think they've got a lot to say, and I'm looking forward to getting their input on a whole world of things. First of all, I don't think you guys are you guys considered millennials? I think millennial is past now, right? You're Generation Z, is it?
I think that's about right. I think millennial runs through 97 or 98 or something like that, so I'm not.
Yeah, I think we're on the border.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the millennials is that they aren't their parents' generation. You know, my generation, the baby boomer generation, got the best of everything. We got the best of the new schools being built to accommodate the size of our population, the best of technology, the best of the resources. And what we're leaving behind for our kids' generation is appalling. Millennials, by their nature and the generation after them, are more frugal. They don't have the same expectations of the world that their parents' generation had. They're loaded with college debt. They are tolerant, but not, well, I guess the word is they're not engaged as much as they should be. They're not participating as much. They're engaged, but not participating. Let's talk to two very interesting young men that I've been impressed by. Starting with Joel, was a speaker at a Black Lives Matter rally in Hellertown a few months ago. And I got to tell you, I've seen Bernie Sanders speak. I've seen John Lewis speak. I've seen Jesse Jackson speak. I've seen Paul Wellstone speak. I've seen Ted Kennedy speak. And I don't know if I've ever seen anybody speak as impressively as I saw Joel Paulson at the Black Lives Matter rally. And he didn't use a single note. He did it from his heart and from his mind right on the spot. Joel, what the heck was up with that speech? I mean, how did you pull it? Where was that coming from?
Well, you flatter me, Alan. But I used some notes. I drafted up the outline of my speech that morning when I realized that I was actually going to go, because I didn't know if I was going to go until that morning. I was just kind of putzing around. I was like, you know what? I think I want to speak. So I put down some of the thoughts and some of the things that I wanted to hit on. And I said, as long as I touch on these things, I don't really care what else I say, but I'll make it sound good and I'll say it from the heart. And that's what I did. At least that's what I tried to do.
Have you done anything like that in other situations? I mean, that just didn't sound like it came off as a one and done kind of thing.
Well, I have the benefit of I acted in high school. So speaking in front of crowds and speaking in front of people has never been a big of an issue for me. In fact, I like it. So it was really just a matter of once I got up there and I saw everybody and I heard everybody and I knew what was the day was going to be like and who was there and what they were pulling for and how good that felt to see the people of Hellertown come to a Black Lives Matter protest. You know, I was like, this is going to be easy. And I just went for it.
And then we've got Berto Sicard, who is doing some work with my organization this year. Berto, you're going to Yale Law School. Yale Law School has, what, about 200 or 210 new admissions every year, which makes it an extraordinarily elite law school, every bit as impressive as anybody who's ever heard the Yale University's mentioned. But the law school is all the more elite. How did you pull that off?
So I think I did well in college, and I credit some of that to that fact. I also spent a lot of time writing my personal statement, and I think it was unique in the sense that one of my goals for obtaining a law degree is to help reimagine our criminal justice system. And my father has been incarcerated for, at this point, about 18 years. And so the impact that system has had on my life is very, I think, unique and intimate, and I think that came across in my personal statement. And so I would say the combination of a strong personal statement and strong grade from a school like Lehigh went a long way. My standardized test scores were decent. They weren't Yale Law School good, but I think I made up for it in some other ways. And I obviously credit a lot of my mentors at Lehigh University, especially Seth Moglen, who's a professor in the English department, for really taking the time to guide me through that process and really serve as someone I could bounce ideas off of and someone who could look over some of my work and give me advice on how to improve it. That really strengthened my writing and strengthened my overall applications.
You're taking a one-year break between Lehigh University and Yale Law School. Why did you decide to do that?
The pandemic caused from COVID-19 was really the big reason why. I didn't want to go to law school in an online format, because the best thing about going to Yale Law School isn't necessarily that it is this ultra elite place. What's really incredible about it are the people there, the professors, the students. And I didn't think that I would be as immersed in that community in an online setting. And there's no point to go to Yale Law School if you can't be around the people there. And so I figured that by waiting a year, I'd at least have a better opportunity to be surrounded by my classmates and my professors. And then I also saw a big need in the community to do some grassroots work. I wrote my senior honors thesis at Lehigh on the history of residential segregation in Allentown and its impact on the public school system there. And, you know, what I found is that the public high school in Allentown is severely underfunded, and it prevents students of color from achieving at the same level as their white counterparts in the Lehigh Valley. And CACLV is really, I think, on the front lines of doing the work to address those issues. And when I, had the opportunity to do that work for a year, I thought it would be as good of an education I could get in that one year than I would ever get during my first year at Yale Law School.
Okay, so Joel Swarthmore, there are not a lot of people who realize the excellence of that school or any of the schools that I listed that are comparable. How was it that you figured out that Swarthmore is a place for a kid who got a 3.8?
A 3.97, if we're splitting hairs, but...
So what put you at Swarthmore?
You know, I credit my father. And when I say my father, I mean my father, but I'm actually adopted. But he's been forever my father. He'll always be my father. But when I was in high school, I played lacrosse. I really wanted to play a sport in college. And my dad sat me down, maybe like my eighth grade year, like middle school. And he said, you know, Joel, you can do whatever you want. You're talented. You're talented at a lot of different things. You can do whatever you want. But promise me this one thing. You're never going to sacrifice your academics for your athletics, for your music, for anything else that you do. And I said, okay. And so I started my college search, and pretty much right away, I stumbled across Swarthmore. And I remember walking into the kitchen and being like, Dad, have you heard of this place? And he's like, yeah, I've heard of this place. Well, it's a great school. And I was like, yeah. Oh, okay. He's like, well, I'm not just telling you that because, you know, it's a great school. I think you should consider it. And so we went and visited. I spoke to the coach. I walked the campus. I spoke to some of the guys on the team. I spoke to other students. And I said, wow, like, you know, this is the kind of place that I can really see myself, not just being a student, but being an adult growing up and coming into my own. And so that's kind of how I decided that Swarthmore was the place for me.
How, in America, where your parents' generation was defined by their color, how are you looking at color in your life? I mean, do you think color was a hindrance or do you think it was a blessing? How do you see that part of your background affecting your opportunity?
That's a very interesting question. I think I have never seen the color of my skin as a hindrance, but I have seen it growing up and full disclosure, my adopted family is entirely white. And so I haven't always had the most prominent of a person of color in my life to look at and say, oh, that's what being of color means. That's what being black in this means. That's what doing things like a black person in this setting means. And so I've never seen it as a hindrance. I've always seen it really as a gift. But at the same time, there have been moments in my life where I've been doing something and I've looked around and said, I have no one to help me with this. I have no one to mentor me with this just on the basis of color. And some people say, well, you know, that's not really that big of a deal. You should be able to relate to people in the same field. And it's like, yes, but, you know, you relate to somebody that looks like you before you can relate to somebody that does the same thing as you. Because you know that no matter what, they've gone through at least something very similar as you in that regard of color. So I've never seen it as a hindrance. I've always seen it as a gift. But there have been times where I've been like, huh, like, I don't really know how to approach this.
Berto, you're a Puerto Rican who went to Allen High School. The odds are that you're not going to Yale Law School. Well, how would you answer that question?
You know, I really believe that all students at William Allen and other kind of the urban public schools in the Lehigh Valley, if you will, that they're all capable of making it to Yale Law School. It's about not investing in the community and not making sure that students have the same resources and also have support for the things that go on in their lives. And I think this community will find that once we really rally behind supporting these students and investing in them and investing in their schools, that Yale Law School for Allen students is a lot more attainable than we thought of previously. I wouldn't consider myself someone at Allen that simply kind of, that this is just possible if you sit down and work through the Allen, work through, you know, your time at Allen and do well. I think that's true, but I think there are also just systemic shortfalls like funding that really limit the students there and prevent them from achieving at a high level. And so I wouldn't use my story to say that this is possible for all students in the current system. It's possible for all students if we really make the appropriate changes. And by that, I mean increasing the funding, offering more college readiness programs, because a lot of these students are first generation. And, you know, they don't even know anyone that went to college. I never, growing up, no one in my family went to college. My mother didn't graduate high school. My biological father, I don't think, made it out of elementary school. And so these are issues that impact students beyond just my parents didn't go to college. It impacts them about knowing what college is like, about even seeing themselves on these college campuses. And so when we can offer resources to help guide these first generation students, as well as, you know, the social services to help them cope with, if they've experienced traumas, and let's cope with those traumas, because that can also prevent students from wanting to achieve in school. And then even diversifying the curriculum at a high school like William Allen that is close to 90% Black and Latinx students, it's really important that they see themselves in what they're learning. And so sometimes students aren't disengaged from their work because they don't care about school. They may be disengaged because they don't really see an interest in learning about the phrase that English majors like to use is old dead white guys. And that can be true for for young black and brown students at these high schools. So that's another thing that needs to be done. So when we make all these changes, I think, you know, we'll see that it's possible for a lot more people to end up at a place like Yale Law School.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. This is listener-supported public radio. This is National Public Radio Station. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guests this evening are Joel Paulson, a Saucon Valley High School graduate, a Swarthmore junior, and Berto Sicard, who is waiting to go to Yale Law School next fall. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you interested in inspiring and informing future generations through WDIY's programming? A gift through your will, retirement plan, or estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave to those that will need a trusted place to hear what's going on in the world. For information about naming WDIY as a beneficiary, please call 610-694-8100 or visit wdiy.org/legacy.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. By day, night, weekends, my whole life, I am the executive director of the Community Action Committee of Lehigh Valley. Although that won't be for long. I plan to retire at the end of May. I have the pleasure of hosting this show with WDIY's support and encouragement. Tonight, my guests are Joel Paulson, a graduate of Saucon Valley High School and a junior at Swarthmore College, one of the best colleges in the country. And Wilberto Sicard, who is a graduate of Lehigh University and William Allen High School, and who will be attending Yale Law School, impressively, next fall. So let's talk about racism for a minute. Maybe you guys get sick of talking about this issue, but I think your perspectives as to where you're going in life and everything are interesting. So how bad is racism here in Lehigh Valley from your personal experiences?
Berto, do you want to go first or should I?
I think it might be useful for you to go because I think we have different experiences. I think since you grew up in a more white community, I think it may come from a different spot, I think.
Sure. You know, racism is bad everywhere, but it doesn't mean racism has its roots everywhere, if that makes sense. So in the Lehigh Valley, there are many different communities, multifaceted communities, diverse communities, as is the case across the country. Going to Saucon Valley, like I said to you before, Alan, I don't want to say that my experience was rooted in racism, but I can't ignore the racist experiences and the racist things that I did endure at Saucon Valley High School. Maybe that's me wanting to be loyal to my alma mater. Maybe it's me not wanting to poke the bear. Maybe it's me actually analyzing it and saying, you know, everything wasn't as bad as I could make it out to be. But nevertheless, in that community, there are many perpetrators of racist things, and it comes from people you expect it from and people you really wouldn't expect it from, the people that are supposed to know better and supposed to be capable of understanding how racism functions and what is racist and what isn't racist, and they're just supposed to know better, and time and time again, they prove that they don't. And so it's there, it's real, it's here, it's in the Lehigh Valley. It's not just in the South, it's everywhere.
Yeah. Berto?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think in the Lehigh Valley, there can be this feeling that we're in our own space, a bubble, if you will, and that these things can't happen here, but they do happen here and they are here. I think in some cases, they take on like an individual form. I mean, I've certainly, as a young Puerto Rican man in Allentown, I've encountered people who've had certain perceptions of me because of who I am. But I think even more importantly, there are really strong forms of systemic racism. There are a lot of people, and I think a majority of people in this area really care about the Lehigh Valley. They really care about our communities, and they care about the people who live here. And to that end, I wouldn't call anyone a racist, but I think the systems that we live in have been entrenched with these biases and these forms of oppression for a long time. The schools are one example, that, and I've talked about this a little bit already on the show, but my time at Allen really showed me that my classmates and I were really faced an uphill battle in things like trying to go to college and even simply graduating high school, that other students, mostly white, but also just higher economic status students, counterparts in the Lehigh Valley, didn't have to worry about those things. And that isn't anyone necessarily oppressing us. What that is the system working to keep us limited and to keep us from really achieving at the same level. And when we, you know, part of it is the individual forms of racism that we need to talk about and really work through as a community, but also the more pressing one is the systems, because we also need to make sure that those are addressed and that the systems can really function to make all of us and allow all of us to achieve.
The schools you chose are, interestingly, not diverse. I mean, I've taught at Lehigh, and in the 10 years I taught one class a semester, so it's 20 classes I had, and I don't think I had, I know I had fewer than an average of one person per class of 20 students. I'm guessing that Swarthmore and Lehigh, or Swarthmore is similar, and I'm wondering whether, you know, how it feels to be in those places. Do you feel different? I mean, what's your experience being in those places relative to your high school and so on?
I mean, at Saucon, I was one person of color in basically my class, and that was it. At Swarthmore, I also take classes where I'm going to see more people of color, but I'll have at least one or two others. But it's not the same feeling. You know, at Swarthmore, it's not like I'm not in a class and I'm looking around. And sure, like sometimes people, like we're talking about different issues, and just because they aren't people of color, they don't get it. But that's the same everywhere. It's not going to.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you're liberal or a conservative or what, you know, if you haven't experienced it and you try and talk about it, chances are you're going to kind of sound kind of dumb. But that's not saying that's a difference. At Swarthmore, they're trying, you know, as opposed to like Saucon, you know, it's like I said, it's the same people who talk about what they think they are, what their parents are, what that means for them and their career and their future. And then like 10 minutes later, they're saying some off the cuff racist comment. And it's like, that's, you just monologued about you and your deep seated sense of righteousness and morality. And now you're just making flippant racist comments. And then when you're called out on it, you don't understand what it is that you just said and how it's bad.
Yeah. Berto.
Yeah. So Lehigh is very different than William Allen. And there was there is, for a lot of students of color who end up attending Lehigh, there is a sort of culture shock in that transition from going to a place that's mostly people of color to mostly white people. I think the reason why students choose to attend schools like Lehigh is that the financial aid packages are very enticing. And by that I mean, I'm sure a lot of students would really like to be at an HBCU or maybe a more diverse campus, but the Lehigh's ability to really meet the full needs, financial needs of its students is guaranteed that you graduate with little to no debt. And so that's why a lot of students of color end up, low economic status students of color end up choosing to attend Lehigh. And that, you know, it's a great thing. And obviously without the support of and donations of alumni, I would never have been able to attend Lehigh. But it's hard for students of color to navigate. I mean, I was pretty involved on the campus. I was on the rugby team. I joined a fraternity. And so I felt obviously welcomed on campus. But that doesn't mean all students of color do, and that definitely doesn't mean that there aren't barriers in place. I mean, again, there are some students of color first-generation students, and the college doesn't necessarily take the time to ensure that they're getting the adequate support they need. You know, because their parents didn't go to college, that means some of these students don't even know that free tutoring is available to them until later on in their college career. And so there aren't mechanisms in place to really help these students along their time at Lehigh. There's one thing that we have to understand, I think, as a society that is trying to ensure that more students of color are educated in college and get to higher ed, is that there's a difference between simply sending kids to college and sending them to college and supporting them through that time. Because it's one thing to get there, it's another thing to graduate from that school. And our goal should be to make sure that these students graduate, and to make sure that we get, you know, reach that goal, we need to really offer more support and more services for students and that will go a long way, I think, to addressing some of the problems that at least Lehigh has. Like I said, I think it can be a welcoming place for students of color. It isn't always. And there have been really very violent and physical forms of racism. I mean, the diversity, the multicultural housing unit on campus has been vandalized and egged and graffitied several times. And that has been covered pretty extensively by the Morning Call. And so that has made students of color on campus feel a certain way. But, you know, that doesn't mean that all white students are like that. I mean, a lot of them are welcoming. But it's just important to make sure that beyond just the individual work that we do and addressing individual behavior, that we also create a stronger system of support for students of color on campuses like Lehigh.
Yeah, Berto, I'd like to echo what Berto said, too, because I spoke generally about the students at Swarthmore and then about Saucon. And Berto said this before when he talked about institutional / systemic. You know, Swarthmore has had systemic issues along racial lines since it allowed black students into the college in the 60s. You know, and that isn't to say that you can excuse or ignore talking about individual acts of racism, like Berto said, but, you know, it's also important that we understand that just because a place says it's this great community, it's this great liberal place, it doesn't mean that they always act and uphold them and comport themselves along those same ideals and those same practices. And so it's important, you know, that we are constantly aware of this fact and we do our best job to hold our institutions to that standard that they set for themselves, which I think a lot of students, especially students of color at Swarthmore, do on a regular basis.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, National Public Radio in Lehigh Valley. My guest tonight, Joel Paulson from Saucon Valley High School, who's now a student at Swarthmore College, and Berto Sicard, who is a graduate of Allen High School, Lehigh University, and will be heading off to Yale Law School next fall. We're talking about everything, race, upbringing, class, education, and so on. Berto, you know about this from your experience working with CACLV, that 79% of white suburban high school students take the SAT or the ACT, the college entrance exams, that only 8% of urban Latinos take it, and only 4% of urban African-American students take the SAT. So white students are 20 times more likely to take the SAT than their black counterparts and 10 times more likely to take it than their Puerto Rican and Latino counterparts. Those statistics pretty much sum up the disparity in wealth and income in this country. How do you fix that?
That's a really good question, Alan. I think the way I like to think about this from a theoretical standpoint is that there isn't just one policy or one law that could change this. I think you need to come at it from a multifaceted approach. And so there are going to be different parts to this, to what would answer that question. I'm going to attempt to answer a few here. I think the first one needs to be focused on the institutions. And so what that means is we need to ensure that funding is at an equitable rate across these institutions. One problem that the Allentown School District runs into every year is that they're underfunded and have to take loans out. And City Councilwoman CeCe Gerlach, who is now running for the mayor seat in Allentown, famously, popularly said that when the school district takes out these loans, it's like they're living, you know, they're digging themselves deeper into a hole, like they're living on borrowed money. And so what that means is that we need to have a real solution to the budget problem in the ASD rather than just take out more loans. And that's something that the city council needs to address, and that's something that the state government needs to address. Because the state government has also, even though it's run by a Democrat, the state government has done a poor job in addressing that problem. And the second part of this answer is the students themselves. And so we need to ensure that the students are receiving the support they need. And what that means is a lot of these students are first generation. They don't know anything about college. So there needs to be programs in place to have these students visit colleges, to talk to them about college early on. When I was at William Allen, some of my teachers talked to me about college. And I think because they saw me as someone who was capable of doing well in college, it was even more, because I was in the AP classes, it was something that they talked more to me about. But students who aren't in the AP classes aren't getting that same kind of support. So we need to really fix that and ensure that all of these students, black, Latinx, all of them, that they are really getting the support to understand what college is, help them fill out the applications, help them fill out the FAFSA. All of that needs to happen on a much bigger scale than it's happening now. And then another piece of this, and I'm going to zoom out again a little bit, is the school level. So kind of institutional, but not as wide as school districts. The schools themselves need to adopt certain changes. And that typically when we see a student who isn't very engaged with school, they're labeled as someone that's lazy, doesn't care about school, and that can really impact the rest of their academic career and alienate them from education. And there's a lot of really great research in psychology on what that alienation does to students of color. Part of what would bridge that gap is that our instructors are more conscious of their biases and are more trained to bring their students in rather than push them out. And then another one is really making sure that the structure of the curriculum supports them. So not all of our, you know, we have very creative students, and we don't always, you know, we appreciate things like classical music in our school curriculums, but maybe not hip-hop. But a lot of our students are gifted in that kind of music genre. And so offering them support for these kinds of things and allowing them to engage with their education in a way that is really meaningful to them is important. Because if we continue to uphold, well, classical music is what's important and 19th century British literature is important rather than the really great writing that have come from Puerto Rican people, that, you know, when we can make that shift, students will be able to really connect with their education, really commit to it. And so these are just a few changes on how to answer that question. And the big thing is that we need to come at it from all sorts of angles.
Joel, you look like you're ready to rip on this one.
Yeah. So at Swarthmore, I'm an educational studies and political science double major, and my ed studies is with a focus in policy. And in the first class in the ed department, Intro to Education, Pedagogy and Power, we talk about the social construct of the hidden curriculum. And this is goes to Berto's sort of last institutional kind of not point. That there have been numerous studies done, and we look at schools in different places. So you look at a school that's maybe like 90% white in suburbia, you compare it to a school that's 90% Black/Latinx in the inner city, and then you compare it to a school that's 100% white in a rural community. The things that the school itself teaches, even if it's subconscious, relate to this thing called the hidden curriculum. They drive slash direct their students in the direction of what they think slash what the group that they're teaching statistically, historically, and normally does. So students in suburbia are going to get driven towards AP, college prep, college, the SAT. They're going to get driven towards that. And it's not just, and I don't mean that just in the sense of what they're taught, but the way the teachers talk to them, the way the teachers address their studies. You know, a student comes in, they say, well, you know, you're not working hard enough. And if you don't work harder, you're not going to get into college. Like, it's the assumption that they're going to go to college. You look at a school in the inner city, they're not teaching them the same way. Classes aren't as open to free thought and discussion. They're directed as the pedagogy and power is with a teacher, and they direct the students on a regular basis because they expect the students to not go to college, but to join the workforce or to join a low-wage job where they're constantly being told what to do, so they teach them as such. You look at a rural community, they're taught through agriculture. They're taught through other things, and college is accessible if they want it to be, but it's not the assumed place. It's not the place that they assume they're going to go. And so the hidden curriculum then manifests itself in all these places and all these ways, in the sense that it's not even just on the individual. They're always going to be directed towards where the school thinks they're going to go. And sometimes it's, even if they don't want to go there, they don't have the resources, they don't have the ability to get to another place that they want to be, say college for a student in the inner city, because their school doesn't have the resources, their school doesn't have the know-how, and more importantly, the school doesn't expect them to be there in the first place. So when they say, hey, I want to go here, it's like, really? You want to do that? Like, well, you have to talk to so-and-so or this person or that person, but there isn't like that institutional support for that student to really get to where they want to be, just because the institution itself doesn't expect them to go there.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add again, that's brilliant, Joel, and I think it really strengthened what I said. And then just in my own research, you know, I did a thesis on the disparities in public education in Allentown and how it stems in residential segregation. What I found is that students at William Allen are less likely to go to college than their counterparts at Parkland, but they are more likely to be in technical school courses than the students at Parkland High School. And so what you know, that really just reinforces everything that George just said, that the students at William Allen are being driven in a certain direction, even if it's, like, not really talked about explicitly, and the students at Parkland are being driven in another direction. And that's exactly what's happening. And when we look at the data, everything that George just said can be proven in the Lehigh Valley.
You're listening to WDIY, listener-supported national public radio. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guests tonight, Joel Paulson and Berto Sicard. We're going to take a quick break. Be sure to come back and stick with us.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Pocono Cheesecake Factory, now offering curbside pickup of a variety of cheesecake, cookies, pastries, and gourmet treats. For 35 years, helping schools, clubs, and other nonprofit organizations throughout the Lehigh Valley and Northeast Pennsylvania achieve their fundraising goals. The Pocono Cheesecake Factory, since 1985, love at first bite. For more information, PoconoCheesecake.com.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Galactic Travels brings you hour-long soundscapes of electronic, ambient, and space music. That's Thursday night at 11, right here on WDIY Allentown, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Many choices, real voices.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Jennings, your host of Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. My guest tonight, Joel Paulson, a Saucon Valley High School graduate who happens to be African-American. He is at Swarthmore now, a junior at Swarthmore. Berto Sicard grew up in Allentown School District, graduated from Allen High School, went to Lehigh University, and will be going to Yale Law School next fall. So let's talk about the difference between how your parents look at civil rights issues and how you look at civil rights issues, the difference in generations, difference in experiences. What is the difference? Do you see a difference there? I guess, Joel, you got a unique aspect there because of being adopted, but do you have a comment on that?
I think that's a very interesting perspective, even to just look at things in the generational aspect. Yeah, like, as I mentioned before, I'm adopted, and my adopted family is white. My birth family, my birth mother is Puerto Rican, and my birth father is African American. And so I think just existing in that plane gives me, a different take on things. The way I view civil rights issues and the way that I've always really viewed them is that as a person in a minority community, it is my job to uplift other minority communities. I can't say, scream from the rooftops that I need to be treated like this while simultaneously putting down other communities that are asking for the same thing. Like, who am I to say that my cause is better than any other cause out there? But I think that also roots me very differently because I think, and my parents, my adopted parents, but my parents are of your generation, Alan, and they don't have that same perspective. But they chose to take me into their family. They knew that they were going to be raising a black boy. And so they have done their uttermost to try and support me along the way and be there for me. But like I said earlier, you know, if you haven't gone through it, you can't exactly relate to it. You can look at it. You can read about it. You can watch videos. You can do all the studying you want. But, you know, sometimes I love them. I love both of them. I love my whole family. But sometimes, you know, I have to sit them down and we have to talk about things. And I have to say, this is why I think this. Let's have a talk about it because I know you don't really agree. But I think that's good. I think that's healthy because I don't think we can look at civil rights and we can look at human rights and we can, you know, look at the black struggle in America as a monolithic thing where there's always just one right answer. And I think as soon as we do that, it becomes an issue because then there's multifaceted issues to every level of the struggle for civil rights, the black struggle in the United States. And as soon as we say that one thing is what we need, and that's going to be the solution to everything, is as soon as we then have way more problems than we should, because we back ourselves into a corner. And so in that way, I think that like the generational difference is there for sure. But there's even a bigger difference in the people in each generation, the ones that are willing and able to come to the table and have those discussions, and versus the ones who are just going to be stuck in their ways and stubborn about it and not be willing to come to the table. Because I think there's more in common with me and my parents, as we are two generations apart, than there is between my parents and people in their generation that aren't willing to do the work and aren't willing to have the talk and aren't willing to at least be open to having their mind be changed because they've grown up that way and that's just everything they've ever known.
Berto.
Yes, I can speak for the Puerto Rican experience. And I won't get into the whole, like the Latinx experience as a whole because it's multifaceted and really complicated. But Puerto Ricans, I think Joel was far on to say that even for Puerto Ricans, it's not monolithic and there's been a lot of change over the years. In some ways, we feel like we're fighting the same battles. In other ways, there are new challenges and new battles to be fought. You know, some of the oldest one is not citizenship, because that's something that Puerto Ricans were granted in the, you know, early in the 20th century, but state status. And so that's a battle that's been fought for a long time in Puerto Rico. We're still fighting it. And there are disagreements within our own community about should we remain territory of the U.S. empire? Should we become our own independent state? And so that's a battle that's still being fought and still playing out. And so that's an old one, I think. And a lot of the education is something that I think has been talking about that for a long time. Access to the same kinds of neighborhood care as suburban people get. That's something that the Young Lords fought about in New York and Chicago, and something that And the Young Lords were a Puerto Rican, a radical, progressive Puerto Rican movement, similar to the Black Panther Party. And so they fought for some of these things. And there are things that we're still fighting about now. Gentrification is a problem now. In Allentown, we can see it play out with people getting pushed out of the inner city parts of the downtown part of Allentown, the business district. And so some of these battles are old, but there are also some new ones, I think. I mean, I don't want to say new that they have never been talked about before, but they're being kind of accepted by the mainstream progressive thought movement more. One of them is a gender movement. There's a form of machismo in Puerto Rican culture that's been very damaging to women and other, you know, other people who don't just identify themselves as heterosexual men. And so that's a battle now that has been fought. Again, it's been fought for a long time, but it's now starting to gain more traction. And we're being able to have these conversations with bigger audiences. And we're still a long way from solving it, obviously, but I think we're becoming more aware of the problems that all people face. And even the people among us who are an oppressed group, even the people that we oppress within our own group, I think we're now starting to understand their plight and we're trying to find ways to talk about it in greater detail. So that's really great. I think the key to all of this is what Joel was talking about, is conversations. He brought up a really good point that people, what's more important is you being able to talk about it. And I think even more important, like he said himself, that even more important than his adopted parents being able to understand everything is when they don't, for him to be able to talk to them about it. And that's what we need to replicate time and time again. What racism has done is made it very difficult and uncomfortable to talk about race and to talk about these social problems and economic problems. When we're able to really have these conversations openly with each other and really sit down and respect each other's viewpoints and understand where we're coming from and try to really bridge the gap, then that's what's going to move these conversations forward and move these problems forward. If we can't do that, then it really, and racism makes it very, systemic racism makes it very hard for us to do that. And when we can't do that, then we can't move the needle forward. So conversations are really, I think, the key.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest tonight, two very impressive young men with the future, Joel Paulson from Saucon Valley and Berto Sicard from Allentown. So both of you have said that you're going to return when you get your education. You're going to come back to the Lehigh Valley. Why, for one, and what have you got in mind when you come back?
You know, we've bandied about a lot of words today, and I think my choice word of the night might be monolithic. And to give a bit of a backstory, when I first moved here, I came here when I was in first grade. And my mom has said maybe forever since that the area feels like it's 10 years behind the times. And she says it not often, but she says it whenever it needs to be said, and it's more than it should be. And so there's work that needs to be done here. And I think we all can agree on that. But it's not just work that needs to be done. It's work that should be done and must be done. And it can't be left in the hands of those who have said it and haven't done anything about it. Because there's a lot of people like that in the Lehigh Valley. Yeah. Everybody loves to point at an issue and say, look, I see this issue. I hear the people complaining about it. But then 5 years later, somebody else is saying the same thing and pointing at the same issue. And it's like, well, didn't we just address that in like the last whatever or with the last two ever? And so, you know, as long as these issues keep coming up and getting replayed in the public court of opinion, in the private court of your household, you know, like Berto said, we're not going to move the needle forward. And so in part, I guess that's why I'd be willing to come back even, just be willing to come back and do that kind of work is because somebody has to do it. It needs to get done. And it's not just for the older people or for me or for my ego, super ego, whatever, what have you. But there's kids that look like me and there's kids that look like Berto and there's that need to know that somebody is willing, able, and has gone through it and wants to make it easier for the kid, for the people that look like us. And who's better to do it than us?
Berto.
Yeah, I agree with everything Joel said. And I really appreciate, you know, I really resonate with the phrase his mother used, you know, we're behind. And that's true. I've talked a little bit about my interest in criminal justice. Someone who's been impacted by it, my father has been incarcerated for about 18 years. Most of the men in my family are or have been incarcerated. So I did grow up with a vacuum of men in my family. That is because of our system of mass incarceration. And what that has done to our community is that I'm not the only person who has grown up in this kind of family setting. A lot of other people in the Lehigh Valley have. And we're beginning to have national conversations about how to address this problem, how to reimagine criminal justice. But there isn't yet a lot of support for this idea in our communities. The Lehigh County in particular, the Lehigh County criminal justice system has shown some resistance to this. And particularly at the district attorney's level. And so what we're seeing is that the district attorney's office in Lehigh County in particular isn't committed to these ideas, and in other places like Philadelphia, they are. And they're really trying to bridge the gaps and address the discrepancies for people of color, for women, and for low-income people. And so we are behind, and we need to do more to really address these problems. I've worked with some really great people to create a new nonprofit called the Lehigh Valley Justice Institute, which is looking to support more research in the area of criminal justice at the local level, and then to come up with solutions at the local level. I think I would love at some point after Yale Law School to come back and really work on these issues in greater depth. And you know, the goal is really, is what Joel said, is to ensure that we're supporting, you know, everyone in our community, people like him and I, other people from our racial groups, to really ensure that they have the same opportunities that we did, that they have avenues towards success, and that what the problems that they're dealing with, that they're not continue to be ignored by our community, but that they're really brought to a spotlight and really grappled with and dealt with in a meaningful and effective way, hopefully.
So obviously we're in a phase of this conversation where we're talking about the, you know, the world's situation and what you're going to do about it. What issues really rattle you that you think need the kind of attention that guys like you are willing to commit time to? Berto, you talked about criminal justice is probably not the only issue, but what freaks you out about the world today?
Again, another great question. And I think to answer in short and then to elaborate is that there's a lot of things that stem from a little bit of things, if that makes sense. A lot of the issues that I see in this country, in our communities, and in the world in general, stems from people just not being able to be open. People not being able to like we said before, come to the table and even listen. Not just come to the table and be willing to change their mind, but come to the table and just say, I hear you because I know you're coming from a place of pain, you're coming from a place of trauma, you're coming from a place of lived experience. And so because of that, and because I see you and value you as another human being, I'm going to come to the table and at least listen. And I think, and you can call that what you want. You can call it empathy. You can call it sympathy. You can call it open-mindedness. But so many issues across so many different, not even just marginalized communities, but regular communities, non-oppressed communities, stem from those simple things that people just don't have the ability to do the kind of introspection necessary to say, maybe I'm not doing enough, or maybe people that look like me aren't doing enough, or maybe my family, my community isn't doing enough, and how can I do more? And that stems to then like the specific issues that I think are important is like educational policy, educational curricular work, mass incarceration, felony disenfranchisement stemming from mass incarceration, gerrymandering, all these different things that are in essence a tool of exploitation, exploiting the different marginalized communities that don't know better because they haven't had access to know better because the same people haven't let them have access to know better. So,
Berto, what freaks you out about the world these days?
So, you know, I agree with all the problems that Joel listed. I think I'll add a couple myself, a couple that are, I think, important as well. One is something actually that you mentioned, Alan. In previous, you know, the generation you come from had a lot of support from public policy to chart a better life for themselves and to get ahead. Things like a GI Bill, housing subsidies, affordable public college, which today is sort of something that we can't even fathom. But really, something I would like to see is that those kinds of large-scale support for those kinds of policies return. Because I think today, you know, we don't see things like affordable public education, higher ed, the way we saw it in the 60s and the 70s. We don't see housing subsidy for all people anymore. Like, it might be easier for white people to get some of these loans, but not, you know, certainly not for low-income people and for people of color. And so something I would like to see is that a greater emphasis on public policy for people that will help them get ahead. This isn't just a problem, a race problem. It's a generational problem in some ways. Young white people in their 20s, mid to late 20s, early 30s, even they are having problems, you know, buying homes. Research done by the New York Times actually has been showing that they're more prone to living with roommates for longer periods of time, living with their parents for longer periods of time than before. And so lack of support isn't just hurting. Lack of support for getting ahead in life isn't just hurting people of color, it isn't just hurting low-income people, it's hurting all people. And, you know, one really great thing is that if we put a greater emphasis on these policies again, everyone's going to do better. It's not just, I know there's a fear out there that only low-income people will get ahead, only people of color will get ahead, we will all do better. And so that's really important. I think that's something that we need to talk more about. It's become a really partisan issue when helping everyone buy homes, helping everyone go to college, that should be something that everyone should support, regardless of party identification or political identification. And then the second problem, I think, you know, I've talked about a couple issues in our communities, at least specifically to my Puerto Rican community, lack of access to higher ed, school funding is a problem. I talked about that already, mass incarceration. Another one I'm going to throw out there is the way that machismo, or in other words, toxic masculinity has impacted our communities. Mm. Women have really have been impacted. They've been really hurt even by their own community. And when, you know, when my father was incarcerated, I was raised by a single mother. And so she had to assume the burden of these extra responsibilities in his place. And then a lot of other women in my family had made similar sacrifices. And that's something that, again, is not unique to me. It's really representative of the larger community. And so we need to be more honest about why these problems are playing out for women the way they are, and not just what they could do to address the problems, but more importantly, how the men in our communities can, what they can really do to alleviate these burdens and to prevent them from happening in the first place, because some of their actions are are really hurting women, and even not just women, but I'm also going to talk about sexuality, even people who don't identify as heterosexual. So I think sexuality and gender are really problems that are impacting our community that need to be addressed in a bigger audience, and really we need to think about that seriously as well, because some of the root problems there are the root problems in some other areas as well.
You've been listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, National Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings, and you have been listening to Joel Paulson, who is a junior at Swarthmore College. He's from Lehigh Valley, went to Saucon Valley High School. And Berto Sicard, who is a young graduate of Allen High School and Lehigh University, and is on his way to Yale Law School next fall. From my perspective, I think there will be a time in the not too distant future where you will have an opportunity to size these two guys up as candidates for some office, I hope, in the Lehigh Valley, because both of them have what it takes. And I got to tell you that I'm encouraged by their presence in this community and believe that this community's got a future like no other with people like this coming up through the leadership ranks of this generation. So Joel and Berto, thanks for being part of the show. You have been listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Thanks for listening.
WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio, your trusted local NPR member station for over 25 years.
WDIY is Lehigh Valley Public Radio at 88.1 FM, also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For more local news and information, public affairs, and links to NPR programs, visit our website, wdiy.org.
Connect with WDIY with our new app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store and enjoy the great music, news, and programs you love on the go. The easy-to-use app is where you can listen to WDIY live or your favorite music shows on demand anytime with our two-week archive feature. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to many choices, real voices.